Chema. So in the course of Srimad Bhagavat Puran, we are in Canto 10, and now we are just before the story of Shri Krishna, which is what the Bhagavat is ultimately leading us to. And just before that comes the story of Rama. So it's very interesting, if you read the Bhagavat describes that canto on Sri Rama as the story of Ramachandra, Raja Ramachandra. So why does he do that? Very interestingly, why Raja? There is an emphasis on Raja, not Sri Ram, the way we are accustomed to. Because as we know, for each age, there is a divine is embodied in a certain way. So in Satyug, the divine is in the heart as the Yajna Purush. So what matters is that people have to be conscious of the divine in their heart and govern their life according to that. In Treta, the divine comes as the king, Raja. So he comes as the king, therefore Raja Ramachandra, because he represents the acme of the divine through the medium which is appropriate to that age. So in Treta, there is a great responsibility on the king. Because if the king embodies the right spirit, the divinity, which like the divine as king. So how would the divine would be as a king, purely as a king, that part. So he embodies it. And then comes after that in Dwapar, the divine comes as the legislator, codifier. So you'll see in Mahabharata, Shri Krishna is not Raja. He never takes the role of Raja. In fact, all the Rajas are kings are breaking down in that. And what is takes precedence over that is dharma. So there would be debates on what is dharma, what is the right way. And we know that toward the end of Shri Krishna also says dharma siglani. And there is a debate in the Kuru Sabha on what is dharma and what is not dharma. And then comes Kaliyug, in which even that breaks down. Dharma breaks down, codes break down, norms break down, law breaks down. This is a state of anarchy. Now, why there is anarchy? Because the whole mold is to be undone for something new, higher and better to come. So it's actually, if we look at it not from a limited section of time, then it's something so wonderful if you look at it as a cycle of creation. So we are in Treta when the king is the one who upholds the divine diktat or the divine will. He has to uphold the divine will. Individuals may or may not uphold. So he has to set the example of the greatest king of his time. And there we see something very beautiful in the story of Lord Rama, that at every level, another thing which is important is that in Sri Rama's time, we see that the family is really important. It has to be established. Shobhinda speaks of the three strides of Vishnu. So the first stride is the family. It's the base. The second stride is the nation. And the third stride is the whole world. So these, each of them has its own role to play. Now in Rama's time we have monkeys and rakshasas and all these, you know, monkey means vanaras. So all there is a chaos and confusion. So first place where you get the basic training about what is it means to be human. So we have that in the family. So Sri Rama and all of them, brothers, represent the highest ideal of filial love, of parental love, highest ideal of a love between a husband and a wife. So they have set a record, benchmark, which for humanity has been difficult to cross even till date. That's a fact. I mean, what kind of love when Rama goes to the forest and Bharat has to rule? So compare it with today's time. Everybody wants the, even in Ram Mandir, everybody wants to control. Here is Lord Ram's brother. He is given the throne, but he says, I don't deserve it. Because he is the elder brother, he deserves it. My mother has been unfair towards Rama. She has been partial to me. So Bharat actually governs the kingdom in deference, simply out of respect, because Lord Rama says, no, you should do it. So he travels out of the, on the edge of the kingdom in the forest, and there he keeps the throne, and there he keeps the sandals of his brother, and he governs the kingdom as a sannyasi. So, but sannyasi, what will he know what's going around? So, there is a de facto ruler, and that is Shatrughan. So, Shatrughan is the one who actually governs the whole kingdom. But for every decision, he has to go to King Bharat, while Rama and Lakshman is outside. I mean, even if I take just this ideal, it is so far ahead of our times. And again, husband and wife. So, now we have, because now is a breakdown of everything before the new creation comes. So people often say, women freedom, women should this or that. Now I'll just read a passage. I'm not going strictly according to the format within the Bhagavad Puran, because the story of Lord Rama, you can't deal with just one canto. What Vyas Rishi has done is he has beautifully covered the most important aspects. And very interestingly, Uttar Kand, which people debate, is there in the Bhagavad Puran. So we can't just say that it's all just a figment of imagination, because Rishi Vyas would not mention it. But I'll come to that later. The beauty of that whole story is that if you want to have just a very quick summary, then the two cantos in the Bhagavad Puran are there, which summarize the story of Sri Ramchandra, Lord Rama. And you must have seen nowadays on WhatsApp, there is a clip which comes just Ramayana in 2 minutes or three. They show the... It's exactly picked up from the Bhagavad Puran. Except that the last part they don't talk about. The Bhagavad Puran does talk about the banishment of Sita. But everything is like fast forward. It doesn't dramatize the event. It just says that finally she goes, she delivers the children when they grow up. Sita Mata goes back into the Bhumi. But all that is for later. But just to show that what were the ideals of those people, I just want to read a translation of Sri Aurobindo. And this translation, which is where actually the story of Rama begins. One is when he comes back after his education, and there is the Shiva Dhanush. Now Shiva Dhanush has been, Pinak Dhanush has been lifted by Sita when she is a child, and then Lord Rama lifts it up. We have already spoken about it in the story of Parshuram, so I will not touch upon that. And then they come back, and then the father, under the influence of Mantra, rather Kekai, who has been influenced by Mantra, decides to banish or send away Rama, and then he himself goes into depression. He eventually dies, and yet Rama accepts. Now there is in the original story, there is a debate between Lakshman and Rama. It's not an ordinary debate just between two brothers. It's a debate where a whole system of governance is being questioned. So Lakshman says that you don't have to follow the diktat of a senile father. Okay, that time. Not like father means big ijjat, everything. He says he is wrong. And as the upholder of dharma, you shouldn't follow something wrong. What Rama says as a counter is not just, no, father always elderly, he has to be respected. No, his logic is very different. It's a divine logic. One is he is aware of his mission. If Rama stays in Ayodhya, the demons will never dare to attack. He has to go right there. It's like if you remain in India in modern context, Pakistan will continue to trouble you on the borders. If you really want to do something, you have to go right inside. This is exactly what mother had advised in 71. Go over and take over Pakistan. This was a very, very logical, divine logic in it. That if you really want the problem to be solved, you have to take the bull by the horns and go right there. If you just wait, it will continue to foment. So anyway, so Rama knows this logic. But more importantly, it is not about his father. It is about the lineage. He is the king, and the king has to set the highest standards of his time. What was the highest standard at the time of Rama of the Suryavanshis? They were governed by one principle, which they had kept it as the ultimate. And that principle was Raghukul Riti Sada Chaliai Pran Jaye Par Vachan Na Jaye. He says, this is what we stand for. That if somebody from our lineage has given a promise, that promise has to be upheld. It may be right, it may be wrong. So who had given the promise? Dashrath. King Dashrath had given the promise. His father, he is a king. So he says not because he's my dad and he's doing right or wrong, but he's upholding as the patriarch of the lineage of Suryavanshis, and I don't want to see him go down that way and go down my. There is no other logic. He's not saying if father is to be respected, the conclusion that people draw. He says no, but as the king of among the Suryavanshis, he has given a vachan, a promise, and I must fulfill it. So that's where the whole thing comes. So there is a very, we take it very casually. Sita is going. Sita is not supposed to go. Why should she go? In today's times, we can imagine the wife should be inside the house. Times have changed, thankfully. But if we go back 50 years back down, even here in the land of Rama, what were we preaching? And here is, that's what I want to read, Shobindu's translation of a portion from the Valmiki Ramayana, the original. What does he write? First of all, he writes that, you know, the work of Valmiki. Now, first I'll read this little bit. The work of Valmiki has been an agent of almost incalculable power in the molding of the cultural mind of India. It has presented to it to be loved and imitated in figures like Rama and Sita. Made so divinely and with such a revelation of reality as to become objects of enduring cult and worship. Or like Hanuman, Lakshman, Bharat, the living human image of its ethical ideals, it has fashioned much of what is best and sweetest in the national character, and it has evoked and fixed in it those finer and exquisite yet firm soul tones and that more delicate humanity of temperament which are a more valuable thing than the formal outsides of virtue and conduct. So it's not about externally how Rama was conducting himself. It's about what he upheld. And that's why when all this temple thing was going on, I said it's one thing to start a temple, but much more difficult to live what Rama has lived, even that 1%, because that's a very high ideal. So in that ideal comes that passage where Sita says, Rama, I am also coming with you. Rama says, no, why you need, you don't have to come. I am the one who has given the promise. After all, you know, she is a woman and she can stay at home. He doesn't use the word woman, but you are not bound by any of the promises that I have made. Now you see, Sita, the feminine, whom we portray as somebody who is very weak, who is, you know, who cannot really, you know, we have this idea of a woman who is totally chui mui. But who is Sita, whom we admire? Look here. This is translation of Sri Aurobindo. She is telling to Rama, what is she saying? Surely my father erred. What a start. Great Mithila, who rules, and the Videha, Videha is one of the names of King Janak, that he chose thee with his line to mate. Rama unworthy, no man, but a woman in a male disguise. What is she saying? We would wonder why she is saying. Now see why she is. What cast thee down? Wherefore art thou then sad that thou art bent thus basely to forsake thy single-hearted wife? That's why. Think it's not worthy that you are, no, no, I must stay at home. You really think I am such a weak character? Not Savitri so loved the hero Dyumatsen's son as I love thee. And from my soul adore. What greatness of love is there. Then she says, I would not like another woman, shame of her great house, turn even in thought from thee to watch a second face. For where thou goest, my heart follows. Sometime back I was, you know, these new, even in our school, some teacher, she was very vociferous, so about all this patriarchy and matriarchy. I said, come out of this cage. Don't portray Sita as someone weak to start with. She is a heroine. She is a queen in the greatest sense of the word. Don't make her feel weak that, you know, Rama something and he did Agni Pariksha and sent her away. We'll come to that later. But look here what she is saying. Who is the Sita of Valmiki? She says, it is thou, O shame, it's thou who thy young wife and pure, thy boyhood's bride and bosom's sweet companion, like an actor, resignest to others. My place is with you, nowhere else. If thy heart so pant to be his slave, for whom thou art oppressed, obey him thou, quote, father, for I will not. Alas, my husband, leave me not behind. Forbid me not from exile. She's asking exile, give me exile. Whether harsh asceticism in the forest dear, or paradise my lot, either is bliss from thee not parted, Rama. How can I, guiding in thy dear steps, my feet grow tired, though journeying endlessly? You think I'll get tired in the forest walking with you? As well might one weary who on a bed of pleasure lies. You think I am that rose petal. Shubhinda once wrote about the sadhaks here. Oh, what rose petal sadhaks you people are. Look at, she says, you think really I want a bed of roses? The bamboo bushes in our common path, the bladed grasses and the pointed reeds shall be as pleasant to me as the touch of cotton or of velvet being with thee. This is weak heroine. People. She is stronger than men. She comes out like that. And when the storm blast rises, scattering the thick dust over me, I, feeling then my dear one's hand, shall think that I am smeared with sandal powder, highly prized. Just imagine, I'm just holding your hand and it's sand. But to me it will be like sandal powder. What? I mean, greatness. Or when, from grove to grove, groove to groove, upon the grass I lie, in couches, how is there more soft delight, or rugs of brilliant wool? Say, I don't want those things. I lie on the grass. The fruits of trees, roots of the earth or leaves, whatever thou bring, be it much or little, being by thy hands gathered, I shall account ambrosial food. I shall not once remember being with thee, father or mother, dear or my far home. Nor shall thy pains by my companionship be greatened. She says, don't think I am going to be a bother for you. Just because you are taking me, your pains will be greatened. Doom me not to parting, Ram, for only where thou art is heaven. It's hell where thou art not. O thou who knowest my love, if thou canst leave me, poison still is left to be my comforter. Final. I will not bear their yoke who hate thee. And if today I shunned swift solace, grief at length would do its work with torment slow. How should the broken heart that once has beaten on thine absence endure 10 years and 3 to these and yet one more. So, just as an aside, when people often say Hindus being converted, Hindus, my take is, where are the true Hindus? Show me one. This is the spirit of Hindu, of Sanatana Dharma. We need to awaken it. There will be no need. One such person standing, and she is a woman, before whom even Ravan thinks 10 times. In fact, he never crosses the boundary that she has set. Dare not cross this grass. And there is a touching story, just as we are talking of Sita, when Hanumanji goes, and that is also described incidentally in Srimad Bhagavat Puran. When Hanumanji goes there, he sets the whole Lanka on fire. Then he says, Mata, I'll take you. After all, what is there? Now nothing is required. Basically, mission was to find you, but now that I have found you, I can take you back. I have come, I can take the leap again. Sita refuses. Why does she refuse? Of course, the occult reason is that Ravana has to be destroyed. All this story is described in Adbhut Ramayana, where Sita is the main heroine, where with the death of Ravan, things don't die. There is Sahasra Ravan, who can be killed only by the coming together of Sita and Rama. So that's, of course, Adbhut Ramayana. It's not described here in Valmiki's or in Bhagavat Puran, but it's wonderful. But Sita says, no, don't steal the glory from Ram. she's confident. She says, just go tell him I am waiting for him. That's it. Let him come and take me along. What greatness. Can we imagine even for an imagination such a character today, or probably in any age? And therefore Rama endures. So people often say the historicity, it's absolutely irrelevant question. Ultimate historicity is if the mind has accepted something as real, it becomes not only history, it becomes also the future. Because the ideal towards which, what is historicity? Not just the physical birth and, well, that has its meaning and point, but that's not the real thing. Historicity is about, like Shivji may not have ever appeared on earth in the form that we see him, but is Shiv unreal? So we have to understand the sensibility of the Indian thought. So when he describes Ramayana, coming back to Valmiki, he describes him as the avatar, our Rishi Vyas. Valmiki doesn't speak of that. Because for Valmiki, why he doesn't use the word avatar, not that he didn't know. It's because he has to present the ideal of the king. How should the king be? King is the representative of Lord Vishnu. That's how the whole logic goes. So if you bring in the avatar dimension, it'll be too ahead of human. Oh, he is avatar, so we must worship him. No, he is the king whom we must emulate. So he is presented like that. Now then there are many dimensions in story. Very often people wonder how this is possible. I'll just take 2-3 aspects. For instance, the birth of the four brothers is by taking payasam, kheer. So how is it possible? First of all, it's not possible only if you regard purely physical matter as the sole reality. But even if you take that matter is not just matter plus energy, you open doors to endless possibilities. And Shobindo talks about this in his last writings on supramental manifestation, that the begetting a son by the blessing of a sage is very much possible. Also, you can create beings. This is there in the agenda. Shobindo speaks about it. Is it possible to directly manifest? In my own little life, I have experienced, I have talked about this experience, so I'll not talk about, where there is a manifestation of a physical being that takes place. I'm convinced about it. I've spoken about that story. So after all, if everything is the manifestation of energy, why isn't it possible for, if you know the trick or know the way, to pick up energy and build a physical form out of it? What prevents it? After all, even when we take a medicine, it's sometimes very surprising. You are taking not just a tablet with a certain action. There is an energy involved. We have not yet studied it. So what was the payasam? Payasam was a way of energizing any food object which has been offered to the god. It has been charged, it has been energized, it has passed through fire. God knows what were the processes. And then when you take it, that energy subtly acts upon us. Does it mean there was no physical act? Well, there may be, but that becomes not important. So it's not like either or, that they took the kheer and they became pregnant. There was a physical act. Surely there must have been. But the physical and the supraphysical go together. That's the whole point we need to understand. That the two things, having physical act of sexuality and having a baby, and conscious conception where you invoke, that's the difference. So it's a conscious conception. So whenever there is a description of a child being born through a yajna, it means now it's not just the human process being involved, that is involved, no doubt, but there is also a conscious invocation of the powers from beyond. They did it through yajna. Mother speaks about doing it directly through prayers, through aspiration. So that is the difference. So that's the birth of all the four. And then there is another very interesting thing in the story. So Rama is Lord Vishnu, and Lakshman is Sheshnag. We all know that. You know, that's why he is always like Sheshnag, guarding him. He says, that's my life's mission. Because you see the image, Lord Vishnu is resting and Sheshnag is always alert. He is holding the earth. and shifting it. So he has to guard him. He says, this is my life, wife, all this is secondary. So he has to be true to his metal, and he guards him. And it goes to that extent that toward the end, he would not let any entity come near Rama. When you read the how does Rama walks into Saryu, there is a whole background to it. It's not like four brothers went hand in hand and entered Saryu. Now he is shown that your time has come, sir, please come. He says, Hanuman won't let me go, Lakshman won't let me go. What do I do? Who will face Lakshman? He will make sure even death doesn't come near me. And then Hanuman. So there is a whole game plan which goes on, and Durvasa Rishi enters the scene. I am not talking about that story. It's not described here, though you can read it. And then Lakshman has to go and convey to Rama, who is at that point of time having a narration with Yama, who has come disguised as a Brahmin, and he says, don't let anybody enter. He says, Rama tells him, don't let anybody enter. So he says, okay. But Durvasa comes. Durvasa says, if you don't let me enter, I am going to curse the whole of Ayodhya. So he is in a dilemma. He goes in. So Rama says, I have to follow my vachan, and you have to be face the death. So then he's, you know, Vasis says exile is as good as death. So he's exiled. Very few people know that, you know, that Lakshman is exiled. And after Lakshman's exile, then Hanuman has to be sent back to pick the Mudrika. But all that will, if necessary, we may speak about. And then Rama and the other two enter into the river Saryu. So Rama and Lakshman, then there is his Shankh. Who is his Shankh? It is Bharat. And then who is Shatrughan? Shatrughan is his Chakra, Sudarshan Chakra. So again, what is all this weapons? So it's a profound science. A thing is unconscious, same thing when it touches the divine. Now, with Lord Vishnu, it is in his own world. It's a fully conscious. Sometimes people try to show chakra as a boomerang which goes and comes back. It's all nonsense. You know, you have taken the real joy of the story. So they are conscious instruments. They follow the master. That's how it is shown. The gada goes. It's a conscious instrument. It's not at the mercy of material forces. There are worlds in which matter is completely plastic to the mind's touch. That's how things can be materialized. There are worlds like that, but they can't stay here for long. It's a whole science. One day we'll discover it. So in those worlds where Lord Vishnu is resting on his couch, everything is conscious. The Sudarshan Chakra is conscious. The Gada is conscious. The Shankh is conscious. And that's why even today we have something called as the importance of things touched by the Lord. Relics, sari worn by the mother, hair of Sri Aurobindo, many objects they have touched. There is a whole movie made by Steven Spielberg on the cup of Christ. And they are conscious things. And that's the whole world it opens of manipulating matter or using it for purposes other than what it's meant to be. For example, if you bring an object, that's why there was so much importance to who is giving you what. Because these objects can find entry, they become conduit of forces. And the forces act because they are just riding on the object. In fact, Shobhindu speaks about a virus. As there is a material substrate, there is an ill will and there is an energy formation. So they are conscious instruments and therefore they take a human body. Just imagine it. It's such a wonderful thing. It's not like how can chakra, that's our cabined, very small materialistic vision. So it's not cancelling either or, it's opening new doors. So that's how they are all four come. Then they grow up and we know they are educated in Vishwamitra's ashram. He takes them along and Vasishtha Guru, all these go into the training of Rama and all the other three. And then they come back and on the way there is a story of Ahilya, who is redeemed by Sri Ram. We have spoken about this story, so it's not mentioned specifically in the Bhagavad Puran, but doesn't matter. But basically, she had become like a jada. And then, by the touch of Rama, completely she recovers, she remembers who she is, because she is waiting for the, you see, her curse becomes a boon. Many times we'll see curses become boon. Very often people ask, oh, why was Ahilya given this punishment? We have to ask Ahilya what she will say. So Ahilya, since we are at it, Ahilya and Gautam Rishi are engaged in sadhana, tapasya of a very high kind. That required that even a mastery over the mind. Tapasya has nothing to do with wearing a gerua vastra, sitting like this and assuming a padmasana. This is all our very, very limited ideas. Tapasya meant mastery, not just over the body, over the mind and the vital. It's extremely difficult to engage in real tapasya. So they were engaged. Now what happens with Ahilya? She is moved in a certain moment when Indra comes, as the story goes. She could recognize somewhere, because she is a tapaswini, that he is Indra who has come like my, assuming the form of my husband. But for a moment, this thought comes, Indra after all, you know, he is a god. It's a moment's thing. And that experience, and then the whole story, and Gautam Rishi comes back and he sees, he understands what has happened, and he gives a shrap. Actually, shrap is not exactly curse. Curse any fool can give. Shrap is a very difficult to have the right translation. So, but shrap is a word of truth. It carries a power and it fulfills itself. Let's put a definition to it. Curse any fool can give. A man with tremendous ill will can give a curse. So curse is always harmful, but because it's a word of truth, it carries within it ultimately a good result. So here is a shrap given to Ahilya, and Ahilya becomes like a stone, not a physical stone. And then she engages in a kind of tapasya where she is completely one-pointed upon the Lord. So all that even Gautam Rishi could not attain, because he was still trying what he was trying. Now Ahilya enters into a state of complete surrender and one-pointedness to the Lord. And when he comes, he redeems her. Actually, she is the one who is redeemed and goes much higher than what Gautam Rishi could ever have achieved. So it's a very interesting story if we look at all its ramifications, how shrap becomes. And this not only in this story, the birth of Bhagavat is through the shrap given to Parikshit, and many shrap, actually all of them. Once I had made a study and almost wanted to write a book on how and I just remember one story where the mother asked somebody to leave the ashram and go away. He went to Nalnida. I'll not tell about the background. He said, but what's my mistake? He said, see, if mother has told you, it's best for you. You may not understand it by human logic. He went. After 15 years, he comes back and says, that was the moment of change in me, and that was such a blessing and a grace that I have understood now. He actually became a yogi, and in the truest sense. So many times we don't understand the deeper aspects of these stories and what they are conveying. For that age, it was very natural. Now we are out of sympathy with that age, because we don't even understand anything about anything. And we claim that we know everything. This is a big problem. So anyways, he comes back, Lord Ram, and he breaks the Shivdhanush. They are married. And then there is the Vanvas. We know that story, that Kekai. We have talked about that story also. So this is where the real action begins. And Mata Sita, she is none else. She is born. Even her birth is very interesting. On one side, if you look at the story just as a symbol, Lord Rama and the three brothers are conscious descents from the higher planes. Who is Mata Sita? Some would say she is Goddess Lakshmi. Some would say she is Kali in Adbhut Ramayana. She is Kali, none else but, you know. But simplest of all, she is the divine mother who has assumed the, identified with the Mother Earth. That's why she goes back. Why Sita goes back? Because she carries all that she has, the strength of a woman. Ultimate strength. She doesn't want to go back with that, okay, I did some great exploit. She wants to merge with the earth. And therefore, what Sita did in the face of adversity becomes available, accessible to the average woman of all times. It is the ultimate sacrifice of Sita. And she was not asked to go down into... She was not the kind of character who will say, oh, my husband has not done all this, and suddenly after so many decades she takes out a grouse. This is sheer nonsense. She knew very well, she knew her mission is over. But in a last strategic sacrifice, just like Sri Aurobindo, last strategic sacrifice, she is the mother. She said, all that I have done as a tapasya, her life is a tapasya, very strong character. One of the strongest characters. In fact, if you ask three strongest characters, Savitri, Draupadi and Sita. So what does she do? She says, Mother Earth, I'll take and give all this to you. Exactly what Sri Aurobindo did. When you read this story, you understand what Sri Aurobindo did. Supreme strategic sacrifice. So what happens? All the cells, everything becomes part of common endowment of the material world. So Sita's strength became part of matter. Any woman having a body, feminine body, inherits the strength of Sita. And Sita's strength is a standalone strength against Ravana, against even the people of that time. She stands fiercely and strongly. So that's Mata Sita, and she has shown the way to all the women of future. People often say, from a feminist angle, I say, if there is a book on feminism, the strongest feminine character, it is Mata Sita. And if you don't see the ultimate feminine in her, you are missing something. You are thinking she is a lovey-dovey, very tender character whom Rama abandoned. No, no, she is very strong. So this about Mata Sita. Then the story flows, and we all know that Lord Rama goes, and meanwhile, the Bhagavad describes a demon. Of all the demons, it describes only one demon. But again, it's a very interesting story. This demon is again a cursed demon. Look at it. He has got a shrap. Forget about the conditions. Shrap was because he was a Gandharva, but he was doing mischief all around. Gandharvas are beings of the vital world. So they are neither good nor bad. They fit into both categories. So as a Gandharva, he is... makes fun of people. They are very powerful beings of the vital world. So he is one day one of the rishis. So he gets, the rishi curses him. You are doing all this, you are stealing things, picking up things, go down to earth and become a demon who is only eats. So now how do they portray that he only eats? Now this is where something very interesting. So he is shown as a headless demon, Kadamb or Kandam, whatever, I mean. You'll find the name of the demon in. So this demon has a head, big head in his abdomen. And he is headless. Very clearly it's a symbol. He's a man who cannot think, or his whole life is centered around food. Now we'll see plenty of them all around. His whole life, he's a foodie of the ultimate kind. For whom what matters is food, food, food. Huh? Kabandh, thank you. Kabandh. So Kabandh is the name of the demon, and he is shown as the head. See what a beautiful way of... I mean, obviously it is very symbolic, and he only eats whatever comes, and he cannot be killed. He eats whatever, everything he eats. Now, what he does, he has to ultimately get redemption. How will he is waiting. He is told that one day God will walk on earth and he will redeem you. So the moment he sees Rama and Lakshman, he says, now is my chance. And that is the time when ultimately he cannot be killed in any other way. Rama tries his hands, this, that, nothing. He cannot kill him. So ultimately he himself says, look, I will tell you. I am not supposed to tell you. The only way I can die is if you burn me and bury me. Okay, because he wants to be redeemed. But then he says, but I'll tell you the secret. Who has taken Sita and where has he taken? Just imagine. So he redeems himself. See, now the whole curse became a momentous thing in Rama's life. He becomes a wonderful instrument to show the path to whom? To the one who shows the path to everyone. So he tells Rama, and Lakshman, you see, It's the demon king Ravan. He has taken. And then he says, second thing, you will find it very difficult to walk all the way. You go to Rishyamukh Parvat. There you will meet the Vanara king Sugriv. And he and his army will help you. This important secret. And then immediately he is redeemed and he goes back to his Gandharva world. So look at here. Now again, curse becomes such a useful thing. And then on the way to Kishkindha, I am just touching on some aspects of the story which are not so well known. Other things about Ramayana are well known. So on the way, he meets Shabri. Of course, Shabri is not described here, but Shabri's story, no, it's described. She is described. It described that he goes to this particular Rishi's ashram where Shabri used to be there. The story of the, plums and which she has tasted, that's not described in detail. So Rama goes there, next stop, Pampa River, which is on the way. And then he goes to Rishyamukh Parvat. We have already talked about the story where Hanuman comes to test him, dressed as a Pandit. And then he tells Rama, why did you know me? Why are you, when I was asking questions like a fool, you were answering as if you don't know who I am. And it reminded me of the story of Champak Lalji when he met Sri Aurobindo. Sri Aurobindo asks him. And then Champak Lalji says, you know everything. Why are you asking me? And then Sri Aurobindo said under his breath, yes, I know. I know. So, same dialogue takes place and ultimately he realizes that he is the one for whom he has been waiting. He is Yudhishthira Devata. And then the second part of the story begins where they all go to Lanka and we have touched about, when Hanumanji goes and then Mata Sita is redeemed and she comes back. Now in the story, when Mata Sita comes back, it's not that immediately she is abandoned. There is a time, quite a good time for which, during which they are both there. After all, Lord Rama is considered to have reigned for 13,000 years. Now whatever that figure, I can talk about it, but more important is Rama continues to, I look at it in a very simple way, that whether physically Rama lived or not, but Rama's reign extends for 13,000 years in the mind of people. That would make perfect sense, because ruling is again not just a physical phenomena, but the spirit of Rama, like Sri Aurobindo speaks about the spirit of Krishna. Sri Krishna established Aryavart. He says it continued right up till the Jhansi Ki Rani. Something of that Krishna. So we can equally say Sri Krishna continued to reign. So there are two ways of looking at it. One is physically Rama was present. The second is that he continued to govern because he is the avatar. So then that's the time when Mata Sita is sent. And as I said, there is both of them. Decide. Now why does Rama do it? People often cast aspersion because that is the rule of that age, and before he could change the rule, an event has taken place. And Sri Rama, as Bhagavat Puran describes, he goes, one day he is out in the commoner's dress. What a difference between life today. I don't know of any king, even a person who give a post somewhere in the temple of Sri Ramji, and the person will be like, he is somebody special. King Ram, the slayer of Ravan, he dresses as a commoner and goes into the, this is how the Bhagavad describes. And there he hears people say, and what are they saying? Oh, there are different standards. Oh, he is the king, he can afford to bring back his wife and have as many wives as he wants. But for us, the rule is different. And then he realizes that the king has to set the highest standard of conduct. There cannot be two standards of conduct. One for the king, one for the commoner. And Rama came to represent the highest ideal of a king more than anything else. He's a wonderful husband. But he didn't come to prove a point that, look here, you should be a husband like Rama. Certainly not. You should be king like Rama. That wherever there is a conflict of interest, what is important is the nation, the people whom I am governing, I must set the highest standard. And that is Valmiki's Rama. So Sita is abandoned. Of course, the background would be that being a divine incarnate, or you know, he was not an ordinary person. He knows, after all, that everything will be taken care of, and she is taken care of. She is, comes up in Valmiki's ashram. She gives birth to the twins, and then when the time comes to reveal, now these several stories, there is hyper dramatization of the fight between Lav Kush and others, but Bhagavad Puran ends with by saying that when Mata Sita knows that now children have grown up, they must be given the kingdom. And actually, if you look at it, story is so beautiful. It is beautiful in the sense that ordinarily the children were sent to the Gurukul. The women never accompanied Guru in Gurukul. Women were, you know, at home. The father was at home, the king, and the child went to Gurukul. This is a unique standalone story. That while the children are being brought up in the Gurukul, the mother is present. And who is the mother? She is not an ordinary lady. So just imagine, she was laying the foundations. She is a path-breaking thing. If we really look at from that context, she is with the children. And the children get the best of both the worlds, of the Gurukul as well as the, not just an ordinary woman, but the extremely developed acme of feminine strength. I wouldn't say traits, but acme of feminine strength that Sita stands for. So Lav and Kush grow up there. And when they have grown up, and then they meet the father, and they know ki now they have to go and take over the charge. Mother Sita says, my mission is over. Not those dramatic things that suddenly she, you know, she says, you did this to me, and you know, I am going. She knows her mission is over, and that's when she requests Bhudevi and goes down. And she comes also from Bhudevi. Now comes that story of Bhudevi, why she is also a child of the earth, which is so symbolic, so beautiful, that Sita is not just coming from the heavens suddenly and manifesting. She is a child of earth. Meaning thereby, if I can do this, you can do this. That's why even till today, you see, you read, you'll have different accounts who Sita is actually. But one thing is undoubted, that she has come from the earth. Okay, there is a story of the pot being brought out, and there is a story of the pot containing all the blood of all the kings whom Ravan had killed, but that's not important. I mean, that's okay. But she carried the anguish. So I take it like that, that it's not just the blood of Ravan was not that gory also, that he was putting blood of the rishis whom he killed into the pot and keeping it like something very sacred. That's hyper-dramatization. But the anguish of the rishis, anguish of the earth, she is an embodiment of the anguish of the earth. Now we understand Sri Aurobindo's symbol. Aspiration of the earth, the ascending triangle. Through life, light and love, matter aspires. So Sita embodies the anguish of the earth. What is the anguish? Anguish is that the earth wants to deliver at least. You know, if we go back to the Puranas, this is her mission. So she has to deliver at least, you know, something which is truly divine. Now Parshuram has come. All the avatars have come. Parshuram is the first time we see a human form. But again, we have to understand that avatar is divine in space and time. Otherwise, divine is there, always there. So when we try to worship the avatar of the far past in opposition to the avatar of the future, we are doing a disservice to the divine himself. Because avatar, divine is always there, everywhere. But he takes an avatar, means there is a context. In space and time, he has come. So like I can't say, we can't say, oh, Parshuram is God and he destroyed the Kshatriyas 21 times with an axe. So I will also do it. Try doing it, you will end up in the jail, because times have changed, context has changed. You can't even go like Lord Rama, that I'll meet, do justice based on my strength. You can't do it. You are not supposed to do it, because time has moved ahead. Shri Krishna himself would not do it, because a code has come. Now it's still further. You have to discover the truth within. But that's a different story. So each avatar has a certain context. He comes to operate in that context. Of course we can worship him. And we should. That's a greatness. Even as an ideal. But we should not oppose the avatar of the past in opposition to the avatar of the future. And I'm telling this on a very personal note. So when all this, right now we know what is happening in Janma Bhumi, and there was a time when the person who has now resigned, he had come to Sri Aurobindo's sadhanalaya and given some talk. And I said, why don't you tell him that Sri Aurobindo is the avatar and Sri Krishna and Sri Aurobindo, all this, I had even written a letter. And he said, no, all that Sri Krishna and all is fine, but Rama is the ideal of India. Now, when you do that, then you are doing the same mistake that the mullahs do with the Quran. Of course, Rama is ideal. But the avatars go further. That's the Indian story. Yes, for the monkey mind, for the animal consciousness, Rama represents some great height, very great height. Sattvic mind, illumined mind, luminous mind, but also the limits of that mind. And there are many for whom even to, follow that filial love which Rama represents. And I am saying this based on something very beautiful. I mean, not just my own understanding is there, but what Mother said once, that in the eternity of becoming, she is speaking of becoming, not eternal being. In the eternity of becoming, each avatar represents a more perfect future realization. But men have a tendency to deify the avatars of the past, which is okay. This is not what Mother says, which is okay, but I'm saying which is okay. She's not saying anything about it. But she says avatar of the past in opposition to the avatar of the future. Now that Sri Aurobindo has come, his message meets the same opposition as of those who came before him. But tomorrow will prove the truth of his purpose and his work will be done. So this, even the story of what is going on in Janma Bhumi, it has very deep occult dimension. We'll talk about it some other time. Avatar of the past is very high, wonderful. But we should not think that story ends there. Rama comes as Krishna. And Krishna is different from Rama in the manifestation. They are both same being. There is no doubt about it. Divine. Both are divine. You can arrive at the divine through them. But if you take that the story of the divine becoming on earth stops with Rama and Sita, then one is doing an injustice to Rama and Sita themselves. Because they have come as Krishna and Radha. And they have come as Sri Aurobindo and the mother. So this is the big canvas, wonderful, inspiring story. Not a story. It's imprinted in the human mind. I don't think a true Indian carries the stamp of Rama and Sita. I believe that in their blood. He may or may not, then only he is truly a Indian or what is called nowadays as Hindu. You don't become a Hindu because your name has a Hindu name. So this is the lineage we inherit, so wonderful. And the story of Rama, Raja Ramachandra, as he's called, as narrated in the Bhagavat Puran. Very short summary. Details are plenty and I think more or less they are known to everyone. I believe, Sri Aurobindo says, that an Indian who has, somebody has not read the Mahabharata, somebody who is not conversant with the Ramayana, he says, is not an Indian. I really believe. And I would add that it's no point saying I'm a Hindu and go do sword brandishing. First you read the character of Rama, what it comes. It's something amazing. That's why Sri Krishna says, he takes up the essence of Rama into himself. And that's why he says, when the Vibhuti Yoga is described, in Paurush, I am Rama. Even now, if you have to take the ultimate essence of what courage would imply, what really is being brave, what it means to be a man, let's put it in modern language, what it means to be a man, then it would be Rama. Not the way our present day mankind understands. That's why I read that portion where Mata Sita tells him, he doesn't say, how dare you speak about me, how dare you speak about, he says, you are right. Oh woman, you are right. And come, we'll go together and face the ordeal. That's the story of Rama and Sita. Jai Ma.